Dave Max Cork History Matters, brought to you by Red FM.
Gabriel Doherty, UCC historian Thomas Curtin, was born in Mourne Abbey on the 20th of March 1884. Educated in the North Mon in the city, he lived on Thomas Davis Street in Blackpool. He became the first Sinn Féin Lord Mayor of Cork City, and on this day, 100 years ago, he was assassinated in his bed by the RIC. Who was Tomás McCurtain, as he later became? And where was Cork at that particular point in its history?
Well, it's a big question, so I'll maybe just break it down into some of the component parts. He was a Mourne Abbey man. I think it's important to stress, while he's very much cherished by the city as its first Republican Lord Mayor, he was a county man and spent the first 11 years or so of his life in the company of his large family, 12 children, in Mourne Abbey. A very bright boy. This was, I think, the key to his subsequent career. He was fortunate enough to be able to progress to the North Mon. But this meant leaving home while still a young teenager and going to Blackpool, with whom I suppose his name has forever been associated, and moving into a house with his sister Mary and her husband, during which time he attended the North Mon. I suppose in the North Mon, it was fundamental in shaping his outlook, in particular his sense of Irish nationalism. A Christian Brothers school, sort of characteristically, famously, sort of was very emphatic in terms of its strong emphasis upon Irish identity and cultural separatism, and in particular his love of the Irish language, which was again one of the defining features of his personal and political persona. So he also there befriended Terence McSweeney, there was a few years age difference between the two men, but they broadly speaking shared pretty much identical outlooks and beliefs. So the two of them came together quite early on. He married, he joins the Gaelic League, and while still a teenager becomes not just a teacher in the Gaelic League, but the organiser for Munster, which meant he travelled around the city, the county, and beyond, and became acquainted with the general tenor of the feelings of the time. And certainly the Gaelic League was absolutely crucial in this. I mean, we nowadays tend to, I suppose, forget because of the strong emphasis upon Irish through the state. But at that point, the state was very hostile to Irish. It had been an incredibly tough battle to get the state to even recognise the existence of the Irish language, for example, through the school. So up until very recently, before his own schooling, even in Gaeltacht areas, the children had to speak English. That had slightly changed through the pressure of the Gaelic League and also in things like the pressuring for the Irish as a requirement for matriculation in the National University. So the pendulum was swinging, as it were, at least we know now, temporarily in the direction of the Irish language movement and the broader cultural reawakening that was happening at the same time. This encompasses not just the Gaelic League, but obviously famously the GAA, Irish clothing, Irish dance, traditional music. So it was a very vibrant time for somebody who was into that scene, as it were. There were no shortages of openings.
Was this something that would have been common within his family? Was this a breakaway?
It's a good point. There was an interest in his family. Mourne Abbey at that point was almost exclusively English speaking. But there was, I mean, the interest in the revival was very widespread in Mourne Abbey and also, interestingly, in the city itself. There were problems with the revival project, not least of which the economic. I mean, the main driving force towards the acquisition of English was emigration, that you were either destined to go to England, the greatest empire the world had ever known, voracious appetite for service in its empire, its English-speaking empire in Australia, New Zealand or elsewhere. Or you went west and you went to that other great English-speaking enterprise, the United States of America. So for economic reasons, both whichever way you went, whether you went east or west, Ireland was uniquely disadvantaged, I suppose, in one sense, from a cultural point of view, in terms of its location between these two great forces. But of course, this also encompasses all the other aspects. Interestingly, although we have no record of him being directly involved in the GAA, he was, I mean, almost one of the last official duties that he performs before his death is that he attends a GAA match. He was also, what I didn't know, I have to admit, until a few weeks back, was president of the Glen Boxing Club at the time of its foundation. And of course, it's the Glen Boxing Club that gives birth to the Glen Rovers Hurling Club. So in that sense, his presidency of the boxing club helped bring in one of the great hurling clubs of the country into existence. So it's a very vibrant time. You tend to find many of the same people involved in many of the same groups. And subsequently, this goes on, of course, into his political activities. It's not just on the cultural front. The idea of cultural distinction gave birth to the question of to what extent this required political separation. Mm. So you have a number of political groups. Probably the most famous political group at the time would have been Sinn Féin, which is founded by Arthur Griffith as a political separatist group. Originally, it's actually accepts the idea of monarchy. So the Ireland would go towards the Austro-Hungarian model, where you'd have one monarch but two, in effect, separate states, separate countries. Of course, there were many people who weren't happy with the monarchy as a symbol at that time. But the main emphasis in Sinn Féin at that time was the idea of organic growth from below, that you create your state, as it were, through your own actions, irrespective of what the British government was doing, so that when the time came to pluck the apple from the tree and that you could strike for full independence and separation, your state would already be in being. And this was certainly something which was very much along the lines of Tomás McCurtain's thinking. One of the main emphasis upon Griffiths is the idea of economic self-sufficiency, that the Irish people would engage in a policy of Irish Ireland buying, but also consciously developing your own manufacturing industry and other types of industry. And certainly Tomás McCurtain practiced what he preached in this area, as in so many other areas, where he founds factories and employs large numbers of particularly local women who are involved in these factories. So, and then, of course, he also becomes involved in some of the more advanced physical force nationalist organisations, perhaps most famously the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which he joins.
So within the Irish Volunteers?
No, this is before the Irish Volunteers. The Irish Volunteers are founded some years later, albeit largely under the sponsorship of the IRB. The IRB was certainly pushing for the creation of this type of military force, and the Ulster Crisis of 1912 to 1914 and the formation of the Ulster Volunteer Force.
So the IRB is earlier in that period.
Yes,
is this before Fianna Éireann, which he joined in 1911?
He was actively involved in the creation. He doesn't just join. I mean, he's one of the moving forces towards the creation of Fianna Éireann, which was in effect the Republican Boy Scouts movement, a conscious repudiation of the Baden-Powell type of scouting philosophy.
So arguably you could suggest he's radically political.
Oh, he is. There's no doubt about it. He's radical, but he's radical culturally. He's radical economically. I mean, in an era of laissez-faire and the idea that you had to, in effect, accept what the market decided, he said no, that we can mould our own futures economically through conscious collective action. So, he's a radical. It doesn't mean that he's intransigent. He's capable of hearing what other people are thinking, and certainly he's capable of adjusting what he does to the realities on the ground. But he is an idealist, and he has not just a sense of the direction in which he'd like things to go, both locally and nationally, but a plan of how to get there.
And where does he sit in the spirit of the time prior to 1916? I mean, Cork, arguably quite an Anglo city.
Well, I mean, it had strong ties to the United Kingdom, and it had strong ties to empire. Famously, a lot of the trading routes, the produce that's exported through the port of Cork goes not just to Britain, but to all parts of the empire, and indeed beyond. So it's an outward-looking city, and always had been.
And Cove's a very important British army port.
Absolutely.
As is Bear Island.
Well, I mean, during the First World War in particular, of course, remember that between 1914 and 18, when the Germans, even though the U-boat campaign isn't sustained for the entire duration of the war, but the sinking of the Lusitania and some earlier shipping losses show just how important Irish ports were to the British Navy, and Cove was the jewel in the crown from that point of view.
So with his radical outlook, how does that sit with the society in which he is living and operating?
To a certain extent, he's, I wouldn't say he's out of kilter. Culturally speaking, I think that he's on the leading edge, but he's leading the movement in the direction in which it's going. Physical force nationalism wasn't strong. The Republican movement wasn't strong anywhere in the country, really prior to 1912. Famously, one prominent Republican said that you could have fitted all the active members of the IRB into a concert hall, a pretty small concert hall, prior to that point.
And was it the Ulster Covenant that sparked it all?
To a certain extent. Now, again, the fact that you'd had this cultural revival movement for pretty well 30 years at this point.
So there was a fear growing up north of something's going on.
Yeah. And the fact that you have this proposal that Ireland be given some limited form of self-government, which the unionists across the country, including those in Cork, of course, oppose. Yes. But their epicentre is certainly in Ulster, and they armed themselves. They threatened to declare independence from Britain, to declare a provisional government. They openly liaise with Imperial Germany.
Well, ultimately, it is ironic that the group of people that fought so hard against Home Rule were the first to get it on the
Absolutely,
island.
Absolutely, yes. And it's also ironic, of course, that they are, to a certain extent, the first provisionals, in the sense that they're the ones who first proposed to establish separation from Britain. And make active plans to do that and create a provisional government.
A million of them sign it, some of them in their own blood. They land arms in Larne.
Absolutely.
And this really does further militarise the situation as
well. I think it's the British reaction that really creates the problem, because the British change their policy in response to the threat of violence. They do amend the Home Rule Bill. And there's a proposal to amend it even further. For example, it's at this point that we have the origins of the discussion of partition and all of that, of course, has entailed through to Brexit and so on. But the reaction of the British government seemed to demonstrate to militants that the British government listened to this type of language. They weren't necessarily open to parliamentary discourse. They weren't necessarily only going to listen to constitutional arguments. That they did listen to the threat of force, and the IRB drew the relevant lessons.
Sinn Féin are separate to the IRB.
Yes.
Perhaps there's overlaps, but Home Rule I think it's on its third reading through Parliament,
yep,
where it eventually is accepted and World War One pauses it.
Yep.
So John Redmond and the Irish Volunteers are happy with that. Yep. Are the revolutionaries in the IRB happy with the proposed Home Rule?
No, of course, because for a variety of different reasons. But the main one is that they fear that if Home Rule is passed and is accepted by the Irish people, it will actually bind Ireland closer to Great Britain and bind even more securely within the empire.
So this proposed Home Rule, had it come through, would not have stemmed the revolutionary fervour and tide?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Now, at the same time, again, to repeat what I said earlier, that the revolution movement wasn't particularly strong, but it grows stronger as a result of the Home Rule crisis, and then it goes much stronger, of course, as a result of the First World War and the fact that the First World War isn't won quickly. It drags on and on with enormous casualties. And for most of the period of the war, it seemed as if Britain was on the losing side. It's really only in the summer of 1918 that you can say that the pendulum had swung in Britain's favour. So you seem to be losing a war that was A, going on very long, and B, was incredibly expensive in terms of cost of lives, etc. Mm-hmm. So this alienates large numbers of people and drives them into the arms of the separatists. Hmm.
Would he have been involved in any of the 1916 elements? I know what I know about the Cork aspect of it is there was a gathering on Shear Street, which may or may not have been the headquarters of the Irish Volunteers. There was a standoff with the police, and they were all, I think a priest was called and forced them all to disband.
That's the origins of it, but it's rather bigger than that. Yeah.
And one of the things was that, you know, after the failings of Cork, for want of a better phrase, of 1916, they were determined that wasn't going to happen again. And when the War of Independence came around, there was, you know,
certainly on that last point, without a shadow of a doubt, there is a direct connection between what was seen to be the failure of Cork to rise, and I'll explain that in a second, and the phenomenal military activity that took place in the War of Independence. Without wishing to go into a very long story, I'll try and shorten it as briefly as I can. Tomás McCurtain, as head of the Cork Volunteers, wasn't informed that there was a plan to rise in Dublin on Easter weekend.
So until he was the head of the Irish Volunteers in Cork in 1916.
And an IRB man. But he still wasn't told, because the fear was that if word got around, then the British would be able to crack down.
Being kept really tight.
Exactly. So it's really only within a small circle within Dublin that the detailed knowledge of the plan. Now, at the same time, he was ordered to prepare for mobilisation, which was well signalled and everybody knew about it. And it's only really at the last minute that he starts receiving word that, in fact, this isn't just a drill or it's not a draft mobilisation, this is the real thing. And then you have an incredibly confusing series of orders, counter-orders, countermands, inquiries, notes arriving out of sequence, etc., where it was simply impossible for him to know exactly what orders he was receiving. He viewed the situation as a soldier, that he would obey orders, but he just didn't know what orders he was expected to follow. So what happened on Easter Sunday in Cork, not in Dublin, of course, because the countermanding order had taken effect in Dublin on Easter Sunday, but on Easter Sunday in Cork, the volunteers mobilised. All the volunteer companies then marched out, in effect, to Kilmurry. And they assembled there, and there were a whole series of manoeuvres on the day. And at that point, on the basis that he didn't know
What was going on?
He felt himself obliged, in effect, to dismiss the assembled groups, which had come from West Cork and from the city and other assembly points. And he had to dismiss them. He then goes back to Cork and hears the following day that the rising is on. And he goes, along with Terence McSweeney and some number of others, to the volunteer hall in Shear Street. And all he can really do is maintain a watching brief on the basis that he doesn't know what to do. He can't launch a suicide mission.
They must have been raging.
Well, I mean, it was mortified. I mean, the feeling of betrayal of what was going on in Dublin, the feel of having failed, which was wrong, absolutely wrong. And
yes,
it is important to...
And not having been kept in the loop, as he would have seen it.
I suppose it is important to remember that he was court-martialed, as Terence McSweeney was court-martialed as his number two, by the volunteers, and was completely acquitted of all charges on the basis that he simply couldn't have done anything other than what he did. So utterly confused were the instructions that he was being given.
And was there then a gathering of men in that centre, and the police with a cordon,
yes,
and a priest came? And
well, it was actually more than a priest. It was Bishop Colan, or the future Bishop Colan. He was the assistant bishop of Cork at that point. He was soon to take over as the full bishop. And between him and the Lord Mayor,
They negotiated
a peaceful surrender, that the weapons were supposed to be kept in... Because in one sense, the volunteers hadn't done anything wrong. They had legally held weapons.
Although, meanwhile, it's all going on in Dublin.
It's going on in Dublin. But from their point of view, they had done nothing illegal. But so the weapons were deposited with the Lord Mayor, and as far as he was concerned, he was acting in good faith. The British then seized those weapons, perhaps not surprisingly given what was happening, and then proceeded to arrest Tomás McCurtain and all the others at their leisure. He was allowed to go home initially, and he was then subsequently arrested, and he goes to a variety of different prison camps and internment camps, prisoner of war camps, etc.
Like the Frog March.
Frog March,
and that sort of thing. Well, great, because I never knew that about McCurtain and McSweeney, that they were that centrally involved.
They're number one and two. Number one and two.
Because the curious thing then is that the British attribute the rising to Sinn Féin, who really had very little to do with it.
No.
Everybody then begins to identify themselves with Sinn Féin, do they? Or they then join?
Well,
how does that movement happen from they weren't Sinn Féin?
Yeah.
They're described as Sinn Féin, and then they become Sinn Féin.
Well, Sinn Féin was as it were, as much a mindset as the name of a political party. A Sinn Féin mindset was somebody who wanted separation from Britain, and that encompasses economic separation, cultural separation, as much as political separation. Griffith, as far as Griffith was concerned, he was happy with any form of political separation that guaranteed that Ireland would control its own destinies. He wasn't hung up on the Republican status. He was prepared to accept the dual monarchy. But you're correct that the British used the term Sinn Féin as a generic term of almost abuse for their opponents. And that didn't really matter whether they were political opponents, members of the Volunteers, whether it was the Gaelic League. I mean, anybody who was, in fact, an opponent of British rule or British influence in Ireland was labelled as a Sinn Féiner. And, of course, this was a godsend to the Republicans because it gives them a label under which they can organise resistance. So when the prisoners start to be released in the latter months of 1916, they go back to their home counters, and they go back to doing what had led them to be incarcerated in the first instance. Michael Collins, of course, a Cork man, he's instrumental in this. He's helping to revitalise the Volunteers nationally. But Tomás McCurtain and Terence McSweeney, with some interruptions, because of course they're rearrested in 1917, and Terence McSweeney manages to get himself married while he's on, in effect, house arrest over in England at that time. But in 1917, 1918, at the time that they had at their disposal, McCurtain and McSweeney were both actively involved in reorganising and re-energising the Volunteers. And two things happened at the end of 1917. One, Sinn Féin goes fully Republican, it adopts a new constitution and is now fully fledged Republican. And the Volunteers, while they don't have the same constitutional change, pretty much the entire upper echelon of the Volunteers are now Republicans, members of the IRB, people who have been out in 1916. So some of the moderates who had positions of influence before then, who hadn't necessarily hitched their wagon to any particular political status, are now ousted. And the Volunteers now, in effect, become a fully-fledged Republican force also.
Wow, it's like a whole coming together. And I know where I want to go to with you in a moment, Gabriel, which is the election that sort of shows the will of the Irish people after there's the small band of people that go out and sort of, you know, it was like a heroic stand in order to wake Irish people up to something that they knew lay somewhere buried deep within their heart. And clearly it did. But just while I'm on this, because I think it would be only as you're talking, I kind of thought it would be unfair not to ask the question of where was Elizabeth Walsh or Eilish Brahannock in this? Because Cumann na bBan had such a role to play in 1916. Yeah. And we've talked about all of these men all the way along. Yeah. Do you have a moment for where were the women in this?
Well, I mean, Eilish Walsh was cut from the same cloth. A woman who was every bit as committed to the Gaelic revival as her husband. A very good camogie player. Camogie at that point was strong in Cork, and she was noted as one of the better players. Unfortunately, there wasn't sort of an inter-county scene, but had there been, she almost certainly would have been on the Cork team. She was, of course, as inevitably was the case at that time when she got married, children started to arrive pretty quickly and in large numbers. And in effect, she has to, I wouldn't say subordinate herself, but as it were, it's a partnership and a division of responsibilities. One thing's for certain is that the children had the same thoroughly Republican outlook as their parents, and that would have come more from the mother than from the father.
Well, they may well have seen her more often. Yep. It's brilliant that they lived on Thomas Davis Street, a young Islander from Mallow, born to a Welsh father and an Irish Protestant mother and a Protestant himself, and someone who lived the legacy of the 1798 ideals. You know, you'd almost wonder, did they deliver? Would it have been called Thomas Davis Street at that point?
And who would have given it that name? Probably would, yes. I mean, I'd have to check. But you had something like John Redmond Street was in place at that point. Great William O'Brien Street, who was another home ruler of...
And who, you know, so is it the corporation that are naming the streets? Yeah. And so the corporation are effectively nationalist in outlook, albeit moderate.
Well, there's a strong unionist element there. I mean, unionists were very strongly represented in the professions in the city, in the life of commerce and business and so on and so forth. But it did have, as most of the councils outside the northeast of Ulster had, a nationalist majority.
They ran a small clothing and rainwear factory on Thomas Davis Street, 40 Thomas Davis Street in Blackpool, and no doubt Elizabeth Walsh or Eilish Brahannock, as she presumably preferred to refer to herself after her Gaelic League background, which is where she met Tomás McCurtain in the very first place. So the Sinn Féin election is the thing that shows the British that this is now the will of the people, and it's virtually a landslide.
And
what year is that? And
that's in late 1918, after the end of the war. But I mean, things had been moving in that direction anyway for 2 years. I mean, it's not like the 1918 election result comes out of the
blue. No, but it's the mark on the paper.
Oh, absolutely.
It's
yes,
the mark
yes.
on the paper that says this.
And the 1918 election has a significance that previous elections don't have, because it's the first election which is held on a genuinely mass suffrage. Mm. All men over a certain age get the vote, and any soldiers who were slightly younger got the vote as well. A relatively small number of women got the vote. They had to own property and so on and so forth. But at least some women are getting the vote. So it's the first time in which you have, in effect, a majority of the population are at least eligible to vote. Now, as it happened, in many cases, people, even though they just acquired the vote, weren't able to exercise it because so dominant was Sinn Féin that the Home Rule Party simply weren't able to find candidates in many seats. And so a large number of seats were...
Because Sinn Féin were on a Republican ticket.
Absolutely. And
did they actually think it was feasible? Like, where had, you know...
Well,
it's like Zionists going to Israel and forgetting entirely about the people that already live there. How do the Republicans...
Their strategy was international recognition of Ireland as a republic. So their emphasis was... It's this interesting combination of, on the one hand, Arthur Griffith's idea of you building up the state from within. Of course, between 1919 and 1921, Dáil Éireann does that spectacularly well in a large number of areas. But they also said that they took advantage of the spirit of the times. Woodrow Wilson, the president of America, had brought America into the war on a radical democratic idea of self-sufficiency and the right of small nations to determine their own future.
But still...
Self-determination, sorry, not self-sufficiency.
But still, like, can they just ignore the loyal unionists in their midst and say, well, the will of the people dictates...
Well, it wasn't so much of that, because, of course, what they said is that in all of the new states which were coming into existence throughout Europe, in places like Poland, the Baltic states, in the Balkans... In pretty well every one of those states, you had national minorities. You had religious minorities or linguistic minorities.
But that hadn't stopped
the great powers in deciding what the new map of Europe should be from accepting that you might have minorities, but that didn't prevent the creation of a state. And they genuinely believed that Woodrow Wilson would be able to put sufficient pressure on the British to grant Ireland's status as a republic. And one really important footnote on that point is that because Ireland isn't granted self-determination, its independence isn't recognised in the Versailles Treaty, Woodrow Wilson wasn't able to get the Versailles Treaty ratified by the American Congress. And the main obstacle to that were the Irish in America. And in his own party, especially the Irish...
Because it wasn't strong enough on Ireland.
Exactly. And of course, that had huge consequences for American history. It means that America, in effect, disengages from world affairs, retreats into isolationism for about 12 years until Woodrow Wilson. And you have the election of what might term with one eye on the current situation of an isolationist Republican president. So there are certain overtones of the modern era in that as well.
Yes, because Ireland sent representatives to Versailles to plead for the case of Ireland as a small nation, self-determination.
But Wilson just wasn't able to get the British to move.
But is there some... could almost be, if not a cul-de-sac, but a diversion that we don't necessarily need to go on in talking about Tomás McCurtain. But I'm just interested myself in... Would there have been a lack of knowledge of the depth of feeling of ordinary unionists across the North and how this... it would never fly.
Well, one should remember at this point is
you know,
that
there weren't any overtures being sent or any attempt to woo or placate or soften or...
My own view is that I think they figured out at that point is that it didn't matter what you said. There was only going to be one language that the unions in also with the unions in the South were a different matter, and I'll come to those. And that was no. I mean, so there was no possibility of any...
When a covenant is signed in blood, it says
you're not going to be governed by Dublin. And then
so the election comes, and it's the first one of mass...
mass suffrage.
Yes. And it is a Sinn Féin landslide.
Yeah,
and it changes everything.
There were three quarters of the seats. And following Griffith's ideals, they say, well, OK, we don't go to London. If we went to London and entered into the Parliament at Westminster, we'd be making the same mistake that the Home Rule Party gave, which was in effect to signify we accept the Act of Union, we accept London rule over Ireland, and our hopes for a Republican form of government would be dashed. So they said we rely upon ourselves. We adopt the motto of self-reliance that's inherent in the name Sinn Féin. We create our own Parliament, Dáil Éireann. We build upon the good beginnings that have already been put in place over the previous decade in terms of creating a sense of national self-reliance.
We don't wait for permission.
No,
we
absolutely
just
not.
Do it.
We do it. And we ignore any refusal of permission. I mean, our connection with Britain is done, and we go ahead according to our own ideals.
And I'd imagine forcibly dissuade those who try to get in the way from
their view was this, as a state, and the state had in effect come into being in 1916. It had been temporarily in abeyance, but with the creation of representative democratic institutions in 1918 and in 1919 with the formation of the Dáil, that state was entitled to do what states do that have been properly constituted in terms of calling on, to quote as well the 1916 proclamation, it was entitled to call on the population for its support, even if that population didn't necessarily agree with it. The same way as the British had, in effect, tried to enforce, for example, conscription in Ireland in 1918.
Or even how they'd arguably enforced rule over Ireland for quite a period of time. So where are McCurtain and McSweeney in that? Yeah. And when does it get to the point?
Terence McSweeney is elected as a TD. Tomás McCurtain takes the interesting decision not to stand for election. Had he decided to go for election, he would have been a shoo-in, as of course Terence McSweeney was. I think his main focus at this point is the volunteers. I mean, he's really determined to get the volunteers up to the highest peak of preparation that they can be.
So he's slightly on the more militaristic.
Well, McSweeney is militaristic as well, but he's involved in a number of different areas. But McCurtain, I think, is mainly focused on that. He's also involved in his own business, of course. I mean, he's giving employment to a large number of young women. Interestingly, many of those women had their menfolk in the British Army. And so it was interesting as somebody who didn't allow politics to get into the way of, as it were, the right form of behaviour. He didn't seek to boycott those women or seek to marginalise them or the families they represented. He recognised that many of them needed the job, could do the job, and did it pretty well.
And might even ultimately end up being useful.
Well, I mean, and I think they were very grateful for the work, because certainly at the end of the war there was a huge economic downturn. I mean, in effect, a almost instantaneous economic collapse, not quite along the lines we're experiencing just at this
and
precise
Spanish
moment.
And Spanish flu, let's not forget, which is apt.
I was going to be my next point, is that the whole of Ireland, indeed the whole of the world, but certainly Europe, is being decimated by Spanish flu. It is a very, very dangerous time to be alive. If you're young, if you're pregnant, if you're elderly. It's also, perhaps, and this is one of the differences then between the Spanish flu and the current outbreak, it tends to hit the younger slightly more than the current outbreak. But that's also, remember, I mean, that there's been 4 years of war. And even though the war hadn't hit Ireland quite as hard as it hit other parts of Europe in terms of food shortages, but there was a shortage of food at the time. So people were undernourished. And this is one of the reasons why the Spanish flu is just so awful.
And like now, cities went quiet.
Absolutely.
People stayed at home.
Yes.
Everything stopped.
It's interesting. They didn't stop the religious services then, but what they did say, for example, in Lent, as late as Easter 1919, is that anybody who was obliged to fast for Lent, because in those days that was very much part of it, they said that you're no longer obliged to fast because this would weaken your system. So there was definitely a social as well as a medical response to the catastrophe that had enveloped the country with incredible rapidity in late 1918.
It's amazing. We're looking back 100 years, the decade of commemorations, and you know, 2020 very much, for want of a better phrase, Cork's year in terms of the significant events like McCurtain's death on this day 100 years ago. The burning of Cork is to come later this year. Yep. McSweeney's death by starvation, by hunger strike, which captures the imagination of the world. Both topics that I look forward to discussing in later podcasts, perhaps with you, Gabriel, perhaps with John from UCC as well. But to get back now to this, I suppose, so is it the election mid-2018, roughly the the election, the war ends.
Like 1918, December 1918, after the war end, a war, an election had been due during the war, it had been cancelled until the war end.
Spanish flu, yeah. We get to sort of maybe mid-1919, yeah. And is that Solo Head Beg, which is an...
Solo Head Beg takes place in January 1919, the same day.
So in the midst of it all, this kicks off in the midst of... Because we, you know, again, we have a better sense now of how dramatic a pandemic can be.
Yes, absolutely. And this just adds to... And of course, remember, there's also...
And an unapproved action, Solo Head Beg.
Yes, absolutely. And you also have severe labour problems.
And arguably, when you look at Solo Head Beg, not really... You'd question what happened. Like it's three Irishmen are shot.
I don't think the people who in volunteer headquarters were overly concerned of the nationality of the policeman. What they were mainly concerned is that it was an unauthorized action. And as an army, if you're having subordinate units, in effect, either ignoring or not following orders coming from the headquarters,
then that was
problematic.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to stress necessarily the nationality, but when you look at the Solo Head Beg event, they seem like unnecessary deaths.
There are disputed accounts of what happened because, of course, everyone on the Crown side dies, so that there is only getting from one side. But I suppose one should remember is that the volunteers subsequently, as a policy which is endorsed by Dáil-Éireann, goes after the RIC more generally. And of course, this has connections for Tomás McCurtain's own death. So the RIC was seen as the main enemy. It's not so much the British Army, because the British Army isn't out on the streets. The British Army isn't, as were the eyes and ears of the British government. It's the strategic RIC reserve. The RIC is the front line. And one should remember, and thinking back to, I suppose, the controversy earlier this year about the status of the RIC. I mean, the British government made no bones about what the RIC was. It described it in Parliament as a semi-military organisation and always had been, ever since its creation in the 19th century. Its existence, it didn't serve to protect society from bad guys. I mean, its main function was to protect the British state from its political opponents. It was a highly politicised police force. Most of the members, of course, are Irish Catholics and probably would be nationalist in their sympathies. But in terms of what their role was as members of the RIC, they were there as it were, the principal bulwark of British rule in Ireland at the time.
They were to uphold the status quo.
Yes, absolutely.
Solo Head Beg is looked upon as the starting point of the War of Independence. So it happens in early 1919 in Tipperary. It's an unauthorised by volunteer leadership event aimed at retrieving some arms and munitions.
Yeah, and gelic knives, I think that was one of the main things. I think it was also simply designed to provoke. To kick the hornet's nest.
And it does. And I mean, you know, we don't have to go through forensic detail of 1919 as such, because in a way, you know, into 2020 is kind of where we want to get and where we want to finish on, you know, on this day 100 years ago with the RIC / Black and Tans. When do they come into the picture?
No, they're not there. This is pure RIC. Yeah. This is nothing but RIC.
Who head to number 40 Thomas Davis Street in Blackpool, and they go in and they shoot in the bed the duly elected Lord Mayor of Cork on his 36th birthday. That's where we'll finish this bit. So 1919 rolls on.
And I suppose one should remember is that throughout 1919, both sides are gearing up. I mean, the British are constantly raiding. They're not, at this point, interning too many people, although if you are guilty of sort of overtly challenging the British state, for example, by wearing volunteer uniform or engaging in drilling and so on and so forth, then you are likely to be arrested. You're probably going to only go to prison for a month or two. But the volunteers, their main focus at this point is just acquiring weapons. I mean, they still haven't made good the losses that they experienced in 1916. So it's acquiring weapons, drilling, testing out, finding out who are the good leaders, who can be promoted to position of authority. The Cork volunteers at this point are really a very formidable force, even before they start really taking to the field, as it were, in a very significant way, which is largely happens in 1920. There were engagements in 1919, but I suppose one of the main thing that happens in the very first days of 1920, they start attacking RIC barracks, particularly the RIC barracks in Kilmurry, which they didn't take, and then the RIC barracks in Carrigtwohill, which they did take. And this indicates that the RSC perhaps isn't as powerful an opponent, an all-powerful opponent, as perhaps the British government like to present them. And this sets a whole series of subsequent attacks upon the RIC barracks, especially in Cork, city and county. And the British are forced to simply pull out, close down those barracks, and the IRA quickly burned them down, which means that the British are then, their eyes and ears are gone. The symbols of royal authority and British rule are gone. And in effect, large swathes of Cork become part of the living republic. It is the Republicans, in effect, who hold sway. And the British are forced to withdraw to the towns. And even in Cork City, I mean, they're forced to withdraw from some of the barracks in Cork City and concentrate in larger and larger numbers in the barracks that remain.
Mad. McSweeney is elected to the first all. McCurtain isn't. Yeah. But presumably then it's corporation elections that sees the... had the corporation been, for want of a better word, taken over by Republican interest prior to that?
No. It was very, very much the existing. And again, there had been elections due for the corporation during the war, but these had been deferred. What's very important to note is that the British... having seen what happened in 1918, when Sinn Féin had won three quarters of the seats with getting slightly less than 50% of the vote, because many of the seats were uncontested and no one who wanted to vote Sinn Féin were given allowed the opportunity in those seats, that they adopted a new method of election, proportional representation. The hope was is that this would... A, they thought that the Sinn Féin wasn't as popular as it had been in 1918, and B, they thought that even if it was, that this would diminish the prospects of Republicans seizing control. Very embarrassing for the British government. The Republicans say, this is actually what we want. We have always pushed for proportional representation. They contest the seats. It's more of a challenge in 1920 than it had been in 1918, precisely because there's certainly in Cork, there's no seats which are uncontested, and you face challenges from unionists, from constitutional nationalists, from former soldiers and sailors who contest the elections.
And what's the feeling in the general public around the activities that are occurring, like the attacks?
Well, I suppose on the basis that one can only read into the way that people voted their yes. assessment, and the Republicans win an overall majority, a clear overall majority on the council. And I suppose we're familiar with the way that proportional representation operates in the system now. And so in some of the final seats, pretty well in every ward, the Republicans top the poll. But I think they make the big mistake, which I think arguably Sinn Féin has made in the most recent election. In some cases, they don't run enough candidates. That they possibly would have won more seats in certain wards in the city had they run more candidates. But some of the small number of unionists, residual home rulers, some commercial interests, they win the remainder of the seats. But the Sinn Féin candidates, which interestingly in Cork City, not in too many other parts of the country, run on a joint Sinn Féin Irish Transport and General Workers Union ticket. So this is linking Sinn Féin with sort of the radical wing of the trade union movement at that time, and they win a clear election. And the elections are held in mid-January, and then it's on the 30th of January in 1920 that Tomás McCurtain was elected as Lord Mayor. And his first action in the same meeting was to say that Cork Council now no longer recognised British rule in Ireland, and that they were going to recognise Dáil Éireann as the sole source of legitimacy in the state.
Which was commemorated recently in Cork City yes. Hall, and the Irish Examiner did a wonderful piece on that whole day. I enjoyed reading how that evening went down.
I was privileged enough to be there, and it was a very moving occasion. One of the great tragedies, of course, of the current outbreak is that something similar was planned for tomorrow. For today, if I'm talking about I'm thinking of the dates, for today, and that's unfortunately had to go by the board, and as has practically every other commemorative event. One of the few events that did take place last week when the Glen Boxing Club, of which he was the first president when it was founded, staged a very moving event up in the hall up there in the Glen. And I was there, privileged to be there with Fionnuala McCurtain, Tomás McCurtain's granddaughter, and it was very, very much appreciated, the effort that was undertaken by the club, and the fact that they proceeded on a scaled-down operation, because, of course, the restrictions were in place at that point. But I think it was very important that some public event be held. And to a certain extent, I think it's suitable if you couldn't use Civic or the Civic facilities, that it be done in Blackpool itself.
Mm, indeed. You've built up a background of Tomás McCurtain. Was it a surprise that he was the person put forward to be Lord Mayor?
No, he was the main man.
McSweeney close by.
McSweeney was of course subsequently his successor. Mm. So the two men were seen very much as it were as operating in tandem.
The senior figures.
Well, McCurtain was the senior figure certainly on the volunteer side. He was also the commandant of Cork Number 1 Brigade, which is the brigade of the volunteers that encompass the city.
And are they now IRA?
Yes. Yeah. Well, officially, Ogilvy na hÉireann remains the official title, but after the Republican reorientation in late 1917, the term IRA becomes increasingly used. It never becomes the official title of the volunteers. They remain the Irish Volunteers, Ogilvy na hÉireann. But generally speaking, and this is intended to signify they are the army of the Irish Republic, which is regarded as already being in being.
So he's not Lord Mayor for long, does he? No. Does much happen from the end of January to the end of March?
He does a number of things. He obviously hasn't got much time to take a number of initiatives, but he does focus very much on the nitty-gritty of how the council conducted its business. He was very interested, for example, in the granting of contracts by the council, and there were accusations in certain quarters that certain businesses were getting a disproportionate share of the council's business. He was also extremely interested, and this is again, I think, linking into the fact that he'd been elected on a joint ticket between Sinn Féin and the Irish Transport Workers. He was very interested in committing the council to compulsory arbitration for industrial disputes, that it wouldn't just simply be as it had been, for example, in 1913 in Dublin, and before that in the Cork lockout of some years before, of the employers sort of just taking on the unions as sort of two bulls locking horns,
that
there'd be some mechanism by which the interest could be reconciled.
Labour courts or just...
Exactly. Sort of, and in effect, that's what the Labour Court has now, and sort of compulsory arbitration. So in that sense, he was very much ahead of his time in terms of his determination to try and prevent sort of the negative aspects of class struggle. I mean, what had been seen, for example, in Bolshevik Russia, at this point there were already some of the horror stories about what was happening in Bolshevik Russia. So he was certainly a Labour man, but he wasn't somebody who was prepared to see the country go down the route of that type of conflict. And he believed that it was possible to reconcile the interests of, in effect, capital and Labour, but that both sides had to accept that they had to sign up to this process. You couldn't just be in it half-hearted, and it had to be compulsory. So it's interesting. I mean, had he lived, it'd be interesting to see in what direction he would have taken the city.
A phrase that could be used for so many.
Of course, of course.
That didn't live over the next 10 years.
Absolutely.
After that.
But I mean, he certainly, in the short time that he's in office, he does begin a process of reform, necessary reform. And it's entirely in keeping with the principles which he'd observed throughout his own life. I mean, on the issue, for example, in terms of his own factories, I mean, he was known as a fair wage employer. He was somebody who didn't give the bare minimum wages to his employees, who, again, remember, in many cases would have been politically not on the same page. And he was regarded very much as a fair employer. In an era when, as we know again from the Dublin lockout and other industrial disputes. Remember, of course, many other industrial disputes were taking place at this time. This is one of the reasons why he's so keen to establish this principle of arbitration, precisely because he sees at the end of the war, with the collapse of agricultural prices, there's a lot of agricultural unrest, with the loss in demand for war production, there's a large amount of unemployment in the city. So he's very keen to try and avoid the type of social problems that had been manifested throughout the rest of Europe.
So activities continuing. You've talked of the British retreating into the cities from barracks in more rural areas where they've been taken over and then subsequently burned down. And the Living Republic is alive and well and growing, arguably. What brings it to the point where the RIC you know, come out of what is now Collins Barracks.
Yeah.
And
well, no, it's actually King Street Barracks, which is now McCurtain. There was a barracks in McCurtain Street that has since closed. It was called King Street at the time. It was very soon thereafter renamed McCurtain Street.
Well, is it that they're getting more and more wound up by what's going on?
Well,
and
there are two schools of thought. On the one hand, there was an RAC man who was killed on the previous evening, Constable Merton. And there is a school of thought that what was done over the course of the following number of hours was simply a response to that. But that would ignore a whole series of clear signals that had been sent out to the McCurtain family that they were in danger. They had received a number of warnings over the preceding months. There had been innumerable raids on the family home through, for no obvious reason. Again, this is raiding the home of the Lord Mayor. He had, in fact, received a death threat only 3 days before the shooting itself, before Constable Murta had been shot. For my own view, I think it's impossible to be absolutely certain. I think the killing of Constable Murta was a trigger for something which was already planned. I think, and again, this is supposition, but based upon what we know about what happened on the night itself, which was very coordinated. I mean, there's no question about it that there must have been a degree of pre-planning in what was done on the night. But I think the decision was taken, the next one that they take out of ours, i.e. the RAC, that we will respond. And we will respond with overkill. But if you have a look at what happens on the night of the funeral, and this is testified both in the press by eyewitnesses over the course of the following days and then officially in the inquest, there is absolutely no doubt that there must have been a degree of pre-planning. And not just by those, the 40 or 50 policemen who were involved in various different ways, but by pretty much every policeman in the city. I mean, even the British...
They're taking them out.
The British government said, well, if this is true, if this is what you're saying true, every policeman in the city must have been aware of it. So, I mean, there's a whole series of things that happen over the course of the night. The curfew is enforced. Lamps are turned off.
Goodness,
people are driven from the streets. There are eyewitnesses who see.
It's like a mafia hit.
Yeah, well, I mean, it cannot be simply a haphazard, rapidly organised event when you have that degree of coordinated action.
Well, it's an interesting, it makes me think now, you know, when we talk about all of what's happened over these years, what is psychologically going on for the Irish Catholic RIC men across the country,
yep,
who must sort of feel just a sense of suffocation of just being closed in and closed in.
Well,
and
what was happening with many of them, of course, was that they were resigning in large numbers already. And of course, the Black and Tans were being recruited at this point. They hadn't been deployed certainly in Cork City, but that happens in the course of the following week.
Is there even a frustration and a sense of knowing that there's a force being sent to bolster them and they're, you know, this, they're being,
well,
are they kind of getting it from both sides and they're,
well,
like,
I mean,
you know what?
I think that they are being encouraged to take the game to the opposition, for want of a better phrase. And certainly there is evidence later in the year, and we have this in places like Listowel, where senior officers within the RSA are simply telling members of the RSA, and this would include Black and Tans, if you kill anyone, you're not going to get into any trouble, which is as clear, is in effect the same as saying kill them.
It's the shoot to kill policy.
Yeah, this is the famous Listowel mutiny within the RIC, where the members of the RIC in effect threatened to shoot one of the officer who told them this on the basis that they're not, as far as they're concerned, they're not murderers. They are policemen. They may be loyal to the oath of allegiance that they've given. But they aren't prepared to engage in the type of, in effect, shoot-to-kill policy that the RSC leadership was advocating.
So as a force, they're certainly not getting their heads around the idea that there might be an independent Ireland of some kind.
It's incredibly difficult for them. I mean, I suppose the RSC isn't a force that necessarily has generated a great deal of sympathy, largely because of what, not just of what the Black and Tans in the auxiliaries did, but the RSC itself, again, was very much a paramilitary force already, even before the first Black and Tan auxiliaries.
So they were the enforcers, the tough
guys. They're the enforcers. But at the same time, I suppose, A, is that they'd had it their own way for a long time. So the idea that they might be getting flak coming from the other direction was very, very difficult. And of course, many of them believed that, for example, if they were nationalist, that they believed in home rule. Mm. And thus, if
that these guys were the radicals who were going to screw it up for everybody.
Exactly, exactly.
You're just outside. You're outlaws.
Yeah, and you're beyond the pale of respectability. Mm. And you're going to, you're what you want is not what we want.
And presumably they believe not what general society wants.
Well, I suppose it's impossible to know exactly what they believe. I mean, we do have evidence, of course, of informers within the RSC passing on information and intelligence, both up in Dublin and especially here in Cork. Mm. Florio O'Donoghue, who was the intelligence officer of the Cork No. 1 Brigade, is able to tap into what the RSC is thinking and doing.
But is this the most outlandish act they have?
Absolutely. I mean, arguably throughout the entire War of Independence of just the RIC, because even though the RIC is involved in a number of other controversial incidents, it tends to be the newly recruited Black and Tans. Now, of course, remember the Black and Tans RIC. It wasn't a separate force. Mm. They were simply the replacements for the RSC men who'd resigned or who, in some cases, had been killed.
Although a lot of the Black and Tans weren't Irish. They were drafted from
ex-soldiers. They came in, but a number of them were Irish. I think that point is often forgotten.
So when they get back to King Street, are they toasting their success? And
well, we don't know that. But what we do know is that they were seen going in and out. We know that District Inspector Swansea, who was the man, in effect, who was named in the inquest verdict as being, as it were, the man on the spot who was most culpable.
So there is an inquiry post this?
Yeah. There's a fully fledged inquest. And in fact, it was this inquest which, to a large extent, results in all other inquests subsequently being cancelled, because the inquest conclusively demonstrates, unknown certain terms, that he was murdered by the police. But the verdict of the inquest is even more interesting than the deliberations. I'll read out the entire inquest verdict. We find that the late Alderman McCurton, Lord Mayor of Cork, died from shock and hemorrhage caused by bullet wounds, and that he was willfully murdered under circumstances of the most callous brutality, and that the murder was organised and carried out by the Royal Irish Constabulary, officially directed by the British government, and we return a verdict of willful murder against David Lloyd George, Prime Minister of England, Lord French, Lord Lieutenant of Ireland, Ian McPherson, late Chief Secretary of Ireland, Acting Inspector General Smith of the Royal Irish Constabulary, District Inspector Clayton of the Royal Irish Constabulary, District Inspector Swansea, and some unknown members of the Royal Irish Constabulary. And there's another bit of the verdict. In effect, what they decide is that McCurton isn't just killed by the person who pulls the trigger. He's killed by British rule in Ireland. I know for a fact that David Lloyd George, for all he mocked that verdict, knew about that verdict, because in the British cabinet minutes from this period, he refers to that verdict, that he had been singled out as being culpable for what was going on. The British had, during the course of that inquest, so negative was the publicity, so damning was the testimony coming from those who were involved, that the British had spun fake news. A report had been emanated from London. It's first picked up solely by the London newspapers and only subsequently makes itself way over to Ireland, which is a clear signal of where the rumour emanated. That it had been an inside job, that McCurton had been killed by a faction within the IRA, etc., etc. It was all nonsense. Mm. And it was simply a response to the damning flow of information was coming out daily from the inquest. So anyone who thinks that fake news or spin is something that is modern, certainly that episode would correct it. What's really interesting about the inquest?
Who populated the inquiry?
Well, the inquiry, it's interesting at that point, they in effect were ratepayers. So you had to be
ordinary citizens.
Yes, and you had to be respectable, and you do have some unionists who are there, also, but rather some Protestants who were on there. So these are the people who wouldn't necessarily be naturally inclined to be sympathetic.
But still, as the evidence stacked up,
I mean, the evidence was incontrovertible. And what then happens is that the British decide, well, if that's what's going to happen with inquests,
we won't do that.
We're going to get rid of inquests. And what happened subsequently is that simply those were conducted under military guidance.
So the street lamps are outed, the streets are cleared, up to 90 police.
Well, in terms of the whole operation, because, of course, it's not just the party that that goes down to the station. You also have lookouts. You have people being posted to make sure nobody's coming. Wow. The thing is being observed. So
They go, turn the house over, but they're there to shoot him dead.
No, they don't turn the house over at this point. They're there to shoot him. And he's, in effect, he's called out of his room, and he's shot on the landing. Tomás McCurtain, his son, witnesses this through the keyhole of one of the rooms in which he's located. So he's shot twice. He doesn't die immediately. It takes him about an hour, I think, before he passes away. The priest is called from the North Cathedral. And what really compounds the trauma, which if you think it couldn't get any worse, is that later on the army then raid the house, even though the body is there being laid out on the bed, and the army carry out a full-scale raid of the house. You're arching your eyebrow at me, yes, but that's what happens.
The army separates to the RIC.
Yes, yes. Now, I some people have suggested it was a deliberate attempt just to compound it. I think it was a pre-planned raid, but that gives an indication again that given that the house was being constantly raided, it was a house that was very much... The finger of suspicion was permanently pointed at us. But you can imagine the trauma of his widow and of the children.
And it's the night of his 36th birthday.
Yes,
he may well have had a celebratory
meal. Absolutely. No, it was planned. Everything was planned for his birthday. He had gone to the home of the widow of the RAC man who'd been shot.
And paid his respects.
Yes,
as the Lord Mayor.
Yeah, and came back, and was then shot, and it was. It was as traumatic an event as you can possibly imagine. You certainly, even in the newspaper coverage, of course, it's very difficult when you hear of something sort of that shocking to recreate the atmosphere of the time. But to the extent to which newspapers are capable of capturing it, the early morning editions, because you do have editions which, even though this happens at 1:30 or 1:15 in the morning, you do have stop press reports coming in and that palpable sense of shock. And it was... In one sense, it wasn't necessarily perhaps unexpected by some, but at the same time, the circumstances in which it happens, and of course, very quickly, the truth and the rumours about who was responsible start circulating.
So there's some doubt initially?
No, there's no doubt. It's just the eyewitnesses, including the family and then the people who were eyewitnesses of what had happened on the streets, because they come down through Blackpool onto the house.
So his wake and his funeral, I presume, are big affairs.
Are monumental affairs. I mean, sort of the funeral of Tomás
McCurtain. What a time to have been alive.
Well, it was traumatic. It really was. I mean,
the city must have been shocked. The county, the country.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you have a look at his funeral mass, pretty much the entire city, all the civic life. Obviously, you have the fellow councillors, council staff, but pretty well every. Sporting body, religious body, cultural body, commercial body is represented. Send a floral tribute or march in the cortege or turnout on the streets. So it is one of the, certainly in terms of the history of Cork City in the 20th century. It's only really things like the funeral of Terence McSweeney, Tomás McCurtain, Jack Lynch. Christy Ring, and what's also interesting that there were the two of the Capuchin priests who were his personal chaplains, who die in America and their bodies are returned in the 50s, and that's sort of the big five funerals of Cork in the 20th century, and Tomás McCurtain's was the first one. Interestingly, to a certain extent, it mimics the funeral of O'Donovan Rossa that had taken place 5 years before, and he, of course, had led the quartet, the contingent of the Cork Volunteers at the O'Donovan Rossa funeral.
And is North Cathedral the location for that?
Yep,
and then
and they're out to St. Finbar's. Goodness. And it's it really is, it's huge. And his son Tomás, I suppose there's a little bit of the John of the JFK funeral. I mean, his action in saluting his father is one of the emblematic moments of JFK's funeral. Tomás, we've got this blonde-haired boy follows the cortege at the head of the cortege. He's the man who's, in effect, leading the van. So, and we do have footage of this on YouTube, and what a guy can turn on and look at it. And it's...
Do they drape the coffin in a tricolour?
You have a volunteer. Interestingly, the British don't interfere with the volunteers in the way that they do with the Terence McSweeney funeral later on. I mean, in the Terence McSweeney funeral, there's a very direct intervention in the actual religious service, and the British divert the body coming back from Britain. At this point, the volunteers are allowed, in effect, to bury their dead. Nafina are also present, coming them on.
Gun salute.
So it was not immediately at the time the funeral, because the British would have intervened to do that, but some hours afterwards, the volunteers come into the cemetery and fire the volley over their dead commandant.
I can only imagine the reverberations that must have caused, and the consternation on both sides.
Well, we're still living with the because, I mean, this is the point at which Rebel Cork really kicks into overdrive. There is an absolute determination.
Is Tom Barry active at this point?
Tom Barry, it's later on, but I mean,
he's there on that day.
I'm not sure whether he's there on that day. I'd have to check on that. But certainly, in terms of the bitterness that's engendered.
Any moderate people, you know, within the city, they must surely be like, you might feel, the duly elected Lord Mayor of the City of Cork has been murdered in his bed by the police that are there.
This is the first reprisal. I mean, the British then adopt a policy of initially unofficial reprisal, and then, even though it was thoroughly illegal, official reprisals later on. But this is really the first large-scale reprisal, and certainly of all the people who were killed in the reprisals, to most McCutcheon, just by the sheer... by virtue of the fact he's the Republican Lord Mayor, the Lord Mayor of the largest sort of city with a Republican majority, and of what he signified and symbolised, it was an act that resonated throughout Ireland for months to come, and certainly within Cork, it is the, as far as I'm concerned, it is one of the absolute triggers that drives the city and the county areas into overdrive. It becomes, by a country mile, the most active area of the country in terms of IRA activities. So the British sort of opened up a Pandora's box, and they found it very, very difficult to deal with the consequences. But they never did. I mean, by the time the summer of 1921 comes around and the ceasefire, the British are still a long way from getting a handle on the situation in Cork. They're starting to make inroads elsewhere. But as far as Cork is concerned, Cork is still very, very active in the summer of 1921, notwithstanding the deployment of enormous numbers of troops, notwithstanding the recruitment of the Black and Tans, notwithstanding the efforts of the auxiliaries. What happened in Blackpool on March the 20th, 1920, is, as far as I know, the single most important reason why Cork experiences this sort of unprecedented and monumental explosion of violence.
And there we leave down the thread until the next time. I feel like I'm pausing a box set view that I'm like, no, I'm going to go through with it. There's so much more to come. There's McSweeney's death in October. There's the burning of Cork.
The Battle of Kilmichael in West Cork. And any number of smaller operations. I gave a talk in my local GAA club in Douglas there about 2 weeks ago. And I just looked at the War of Independence in the Douglas Rochestown area. And there is things happening almost on a daily basis by late 1920 and early 1921. And that wouldn't be necessarily an area that would be considered to be one of the hotspots. But, I mean, all of Cork, whether you're talking about the Cork No. 1 Brigade, which is the city and sort of East Cork, the No. 2 Brigade, which is up in the north, or Cork No. 3 Brigade out in West Cork, they're all phenomenally active. And all three of them, I think, are inspired to doing what they're doing, at least in part, by a determination to avenge the death of Tomás McCurtain.
And there we'll take it up next time around. Gabriel Doherty, UCC, thank you so much for joining me on this Cork History Matters podcast, episode 1. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a Red FM podcast. For more extra content, go to redextra.ie.